I'm assuming that means we are good to go, right?
Karen, this is Matt. Do we have a quorum now? Karen or Kim?
Yes, we do. We have a quorum.
All set, Mayor.
All right, great. Sorry, I'm on the road trying to get back to my desk. Unfortunately, I didn't make it in time. So I'd like to call the meeting to order. It's 12:01. I like to, and I'm going off of not having agenda in front of me either. So somebody might have to help me out because unfortunately I can't load that and Zoom simultaneously.
No, understood, Mayor. Understood.
Hearing none, I'll close. I will close the public comment session. Before we open and get into the agenda, I would like everybody to just join us in a moment of silence. I think, you know, everybody has deep and saddened hearts with what happened to our officers in Bristol. And I believe just a moment of silence and reflection and support for our law enforcement is necessary. So please join me. Thank you very much. Sorry, I still can't open up my agenda. What's next, Matt?
So the next item, Mayor, is approval of minutes. You want to take a motion to approve?
I got it. So we have a motion. State your name first before you make the motion, please.
Lori Spielman, I make a motion that we accept the minutes.
Steve Jones, Tolland, I'll second that.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks, Steve. Any questions or comments on that? All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion carries. Thanks very much. Monthly reports, right?
Next, Mayor, we have a presentation.
Oh, sorry.
That's fine. We have a presentation.
I promise. I'm pulling into City Hall's driveway like right now.
I'm happy to kick it off, Mayor.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. Matt Hart here. Very pleased to introduce Andy Zilowski. I apologize, Andy, if I pronounced your name incorrectly. But Andy is he's been our project manager for this project. We're going to have an update on our region micro mobility feasibility study, and also Mike Cipriano and Caitlin Palmer from our team have been very involved in this. So welcome, Andy. Glad to have you. And we'll turn the floor over to you.
Excellent. Thank you. Let me just share my screen and get going. Let's see. Okay, let me know if you see the PowerPoint.
Looks good.
You see it? Okay, perfect. So thank you all today for joining us. I'm here to present about the CROG Micromobility Feasibility Study. This has been a project that we've been working on for about 7 months now. Go to the next slide. So today's agenda, we're going to start off by just giving a quick background of what micromobility is and sort of the context for this study, then talk about study findings, and from there, implementation recommendations, and then finally, next steps. So I'll start with some background. So in case you're not familiar, micromobility refers to a wide range of vehicle types. What they all share is that they're small, they're lightweight, personal mobility devices that are either self-powered or electrically powered. So what we have up on the screen here are sort of the three most common types of micromobility, which are bike share, e-bike share, which is electric bikes that you still pedal, but you get a little bit of a boost from an electric motor, and then e-scooters, like what we see in Hartford with Super Pedestrian. What is interesting is that this is an industry that is really changing and rapidly growing, and part of the study was sort of to respond to that growth and change. So the first micromobility systems to open in North America were in 2010, or I should say in the US, were in 2010, and those were bike share programs in Minneapolis and DC. A lot of these early programs were established by either nonprofits or directly by local jurisdictions, local governments. So very much kind of a public sector driven industry, not a whole lot of profit motivation in those early programs. By 2014, there were several systems across the country, and CROG itself had initiated a feasibility study called the Metro Hartford Regional Bike Share Plan that looked at the feasibility of creating a program locally. That same year, we saw 18 million trips happen nationwide on bike share. By 2017, we saw the arrival of dockless private micromobility companies. So this was the first time that we saw significant private investment in programs that really popped up in a lot of communities overnight, including, you know, Hartford had some experience with Lyme a few years ago as well. That would be kind of an example. That same year, bike share ridership was at 35 million, so double what it was just a few years earlier. 2018, we saw the first scooter, electric scooter programs launch. And by 2021, Hartford had joined kind of a scooter party with Super Pedestrian launching operations in Hartford. Again, that same year, bike share ridership was at 66 million, so double what it was back in 2017. And scooters went from zero to basically 50% of the micromobility market. So you can see here really rapid growth. And that growth is expected to continue. So McKinsey did a report 2 years ago looking at the future of the industry, and they estimate that the industry will quadruple in size globally over the next decade. We also expect that there's going to be a little bit more stability. Early micromobility operators kind of came and went at a pretty rapid clip, and that was just because there were so many different companies trying their luck in the industry. The focus was really growth over profit, and that's changing to some degree. So we expect some more stability as we move forward. The other thing to keep an eye out for is that today, micromobility is largely bike share and scooter share, but that's probably going to change over the next decade as new modes are developed and launched. So there's already talk of opportunities for micromobility to take on things like urban cargo. So, you know, electric bikes that have room to provide first mile, last mile deliveries in cities. You know, there's exploration of multi-passenger micromobility, so like low speed microcars. And there's also talk of, you know, having customized solutions for different climates and speeds. So not just sort of having the same solution for, you know, Florida and Maine. So a lot of exciting stuff. None of those have really reached fruition in the market in a large scale way, but they probably will over the next decade. And this points to a need for regulatory catch up. So a lot of communities have been left flat footed when bike share first popped up, and then dockless bike share, and then e-scooters. And as we continue to see all of these different modes come and go and innovations to occur, it's important to figure out how we can create a structure to manage this in a positive way and adapt to, you know, new modes or technologies as they arise. So that was really a motivator for this study, and really one of three, I should say. The first was to update that 2014 Hartford bike share plan, take in new data, changes in the industry, and create something that reflected the realities today in 2022. The second was to investigate the feasibility of a regional program that would span CROG's jurisdictions. And then finally, come up with a solution for what a regional program could actually look like. Because, you know, in reality, it can be challenging to manage and create a system that would encompass multiple towns and cities. The project was guided by a technical advisory committee consisting of representatives from different towns, community groups, nonprofits, other kind of key stakeholders. And we collaboratively developed with them a vision statement and mission statement, which we have up on the screen here. The vision is a region where both residents and visitors of all incomes and abilities can travel in a convenient and sustainable way that benefits environmental and personal health. And then our mission statement was to provide a high quality micromobility program that's safe, reliable, affordable, accessible, equitable, and flexible, connecting users to where they want to go. So that was the background, but I want to also tell you a little bit about our study findings. So, the study started by doing a market analysis to understand what does the demand look like in the Hartford region or in the CROG region. We looked at a whole wide variety of data, everything from demographics to land uses. We tried to identify different potential user groups and where they lived and congregated and traveled to. And all of this rolled up into an understanding that there's really kind of what we see three tiers of a market in the region. The first is what we're considering the core markets, which is Hartford and to a smaller scale stores, Mansfield around Yukon. These are two places where we see enough demand for a standalone system in either community. And Hartford sort of proves the point because Super Pedestrian is already active in Hartford with a scooter program. These are places that have a lot of density, a lot of demand, and can self-sustain a micromobility program. We then around Hartford have what we consider secondary markets. So these are places where we do see opportunities and demand for micromobility, but they would function best as part of a regional system. So if you're in West Hartford, a lot of the micromobility trips will likely cross a border into Hartford and go back and forth. So these communities might not really work as a standalone isolated system, but could be quite successful as part of a regional program. And then finally, we see more limited opportunities beyond this kind of core geography in you know, select locations. So things like historic town centers or in recreational destinations. So we don't want to limit the scope of a micromobility program to just these jurisdictions, but this is sort of what we consider the core market. What this means in terms of the number of vehicles is that we estimated out the number of vehicles that would be needed to serve what we see sort of the key demand generators within each of these markets. You'll see Hartford, we're estimating about 500 vehicles, which is actually where Super Pedestrian is today. Stores, Mansfield, 100, East Hartford, 100, West Hartford, 125, New Britain, 200, and Manchester, 50. These numbers aren't certainly not set in stone. So if demand warranted, you know, we definitely would encourage increasing the number of vehicles available in each of these markets to meet demand. But just kind of gives us an idea of sort of the scale of the program that we're talking about. We also tried to develop what the proposed system type would look like and came up with four key attributes. The first is we're envisioning a program that relies on electrically powered vehicles. So those would be e-bikes and or e-scooters. That's really where we're seeing the market headed. There's a lot more demand for e-bikes and e-scooters than just conventional bike share bikes. A big consumer preference in that direction. So we kind of wanted to align with where with what people actually want to use. The second is that we're envisioning a dockless program. So if you're familiar with systems in places like Boston or New York, those are dock programs where the bike share bikes physically have to be docked into stations. Those tend to be more costly, oftentimes quite a bit more costly to implement. So we lean toward a dockless solution. The third is we want a program that introduces adaptive options. So micromobility devices that can be used by people with certain mobility limitations or mobility disabilities. This is an area that we're seeing a lot of innovation and growth over the last few years. And we think that a program in the region should take advantage of those new types of equipment. And then finally, we're envisioning a privately owned and operated system along the lines of how scooters operate in Hartford today. So a vendor would provide the equipment, operate the program, and recoup their costs largely from user fees. So then the final step in the study was trying to figure out how implementation could work in the region. And we began this process by looking at some key considerations. So we want to build on the successful model that's already in Hartford instead of reinventing the wheel or starting from scratch. We wanted to remove barriers to interjurisdictional travel. We see a lot of benefits for a regional approach. People aren't, you know, confining their trips to just, you know, the boundary of their town. They go to where they want to go, and we want to ensure that micromobility in the region can cover the types of trips that we expect to occur on micromobility. We want a system that's scalable, but also a system that reduces the burden on individual towns and communities, because it can be pretty daunting to figure out, how do I regulate this? How do I procure this? How do I manage it day to day? So instead, we see a regional program as a way that jurisdictions can opt into the program without figuring out all the nuts and bolts of how to manage one. So we have four kind of key aspects of our recommendation. which we're calling a mobility collective. The first is that the program would be centrally managed and governed by a committee consisting of all of the participating jurisdictions. The program would be managed by what we call program manager. So this would be a person or persons who would handle things like day-to-day contract management and oversight. So instead of having each jurisdiction kind of responsible for overseeing the small bit of the program in their community, it would be centrally managed to reduce the burden on jurisdictions. We're envisioning that this program would start as a limited period pilot, so 1 or 2 years. And then finally, the operator would be procured through a competitive RFP process. So the centralized program manager is really a kind of a linchpin for all of this. So we wanted to explain that a little bit more. The first aspect of that is, what level of effort do you actually need to manage a regional program at the scale that we were talking about? And it's not a huge burden. We're estimating about one full-time equivalent staff person to manage this program. The second question is, where would this be housed? Who's going to actually be the program manager? And we've identified a variety of options, including CROG. But at this point, you know, we haven't, you know, selected a single organization, and there's several options within the region. It could be a regional entity, it could be a state entity, it could even be an individual jurisdiction that kind of wants to take on that role on behalf of other participating jurisdictions. There's a whole wide variety of models out there for how this is done. And then finally, we identified key responsibilities for the program manager. So they would really be the day-to-day contact with the operator. They would be facilitating conversations with all the participating jurisdictions, managing the contract, managing procurement, handling public communications and program monitoring, even grant management. So a whole wide variety of responsibilities. So one question we always get is, okay, so how much would this cost? We're envisioning that with this kind of regional mobility collective model, where a private company is really providing the service, that it would be fairly low cost to the region. The biggest cost would be funding this position that would be managing the program. There could be some other subsidies that go directly to the operator. So Super Pedestrian today in Hartford is not subsidized at all. It's purely privately funded through user fees. But there could be an opportunity to provide a subsidy in some limited cases. So maybe we want to have a more expansive equity program that just wouldn't be financially viable for an operator. Perhaps that's where a subsidy could go to. Maybe we want to include a requirement to serve jurisdictions that, you know, serve some sort of public policy need, but have a lower demand and might not be market feasible for an operator without support. That's another option. There's also could just be a direct minimum revenue guarantee to provide a little bit more stability for the operator. There's several different ways that funding could come into play. And a lot of that is going to be up to the procurement process. So at this time, you know, we had some estimates in the plan of what the cost could look like, but those could look a bit different once you go through procurement. So in terms of next steps, we've identified a few key next steps to move forward from plan to reality. The first is figuring out who the program manager would be, because they're really going to be the ones to kind of get the ball rolling on implementation. From there, the region would have to define the pilot geography and establish a governance committee. It's important to find jurisdictions that A, are willing to participate, but also B, are a good geographic fit. So we don't want, you know, three jurisdictions that are 5 or 10 miles away from each other and couldn't form kind of a viable whole as a system. Once the participating jurisdictions join in, then it's up to them to come up with things like committee bylaws, how are decisions going to be made, what are the legal agreements that are going to have to come into play to make the program work. From there, identify the seed funding to support the program, and then finally finalize the program requirements and procure a vendor to operate the program. I have this little arrow here going back to funding, because the procurement process, which would be competitive, might find that there's, you know, less funding need than initially assumed or more funding need. So this might be a little bit of a circular process between fundraising and procurement. Finally, I wanted to end with some outstanding issues that we identified as part of the plan. The first is, who's going to be the lead entity? Who's going to be the program manager? We haven't yet finalized that detail. The second question is this program going to have a single operator or potentially procure multiple vendors to run the program? You know, there's pros and cons of both approaches. Third is which jurisdictions would participate in the mobility collective? You know, ideally, when we look at those blue and orange colored communities in the slide, all of those as one complete entity would be a great market to launch us in, but you know, we understand it might be a smaller scale pilot. And then finally, what mechanisms exist to actually use public funds to support the system? There might be limitations in how public funds can be applied for micromobility. So with that, I'm going to stop talking. I know I threw a lot of details out at everyone, but I welcome any questions. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Andy. Are there any questions?
I have a question. Erin, this is Wendy from Simsbury.
Go ahead, Wendy.
So I was familiar with the scooters and bikes downtown Hartford when I was there. And one of the questions I have, you know, maybe premature, but if there's kind of like certain locations and municipalities that want to be part of the funding, and if we go with the dockless system, I know that people can leave bikes wherever they want to leave them, correct? And so if you, with the trail network that we're building and everything, if somebody leaves them in a community that's not really interested or being part of the network, who comes and picks up the bike? Who manages people just leaving a bike or scooter somewhere randomly in Simsbury?
Yeah, great question. So the first thing to point out is that there's actually jurisdictions have a lot more flexibility than they might have had a few years ago to regulate specifically where you can ride or even park these bikes because of just improvements in geolocation and GPS. So in other communities, including in Hartford, if you've ridden the super pedestrian scooters, if you are riding through, say, a park, the vehicles will be throttled to 8 miles per hour instead of, I think, the 15 miles per hour, which is the maximum. And then there's places where you're not allowed to ride at all, so the vehicle will beep and then eventually stop. There's also, you can define geofenced areas where people can park and leave the bikes. Now, it's not accurate to the degree that you can say, like, these 5 square feet of sidewalk you can park, but this adjacent area you can't. Maybe one day it'll get there, but not quite yet. So the technology is helping to kind of solve some of these issues of people just parking in the wrong places or parking incorrectly. Also, users are required to take a photo once they end their trip. Okay. So there's some record. So the second part of your question is who's responsible for moving it. So ideally, the vendor is going to be the one who's going to pick up and move vehicles. And as part of the RFP, there should be requirements on how quickly they respond to any requests or needs. That being said, if it's like a emergency issue or something that the vendor hasn't been responsive for, you know, we envision that jurisdictions would have the power to impound vehicles and then charge the vendor back for the cost of that impounding. That's a pretty common practice. So ideally, that would be a very rare circumstance because the vendor would be incentivized to respond quickly instead of be fined or pay.
Right. Thank you. I guess I'm a little behind on the technology, so thanks for catching me up.
Thanks, Wendy.
I had a question, Bob Bessel from Canton. We're noticing that, you know, with these vehicles and many others, that the roads are becoming complicated. Not just busy, but complicated. There are many more places for a driver to look, for a pedestrian to look, for really for any of us who are using the roads to look. So I'm thinking there could be an education component, maybe even some thought in as to sort of separating some of the micro mobility options from car and truck traffic. Seems like we've got some accidents waiting to happen. We don't want to have them happen at all.
No, great point. I mean, I think one of the best ways to improve safety is to increase visibility. And that is partially a function of how many people are using the system. So we've seen, especially if scooters, when they first launched, a lot of accidents. Kind of got a bad rap, but over the last few years, the accident rates have basically been flat, even as ridership has increased quite significantly. So we're seeing evidence that in places where scooters are becoming more and more popular, accident rates kind of stabilize or go down. So just having a density of users is important. The other thing is, I think, speed limits. So if these vehicles are going to be in things like bike lanes or trails, they certainly shouldn't be able to go 25, 30 miles per hour. They should be restricted to speeds that would, you know, be expected for a self-powered bike. And that's something that a lot of jurisdictions and states even regulated. So super pedestrian is limited to, for example, 15 miles per hour, which would be basically the speed of a fairly rigorous bike ride.
And Mayor, this is Randall. May I make a comment?
Yes, please.
So I would, and I apologize because I was at a meeting earlier, if some of this has already been said, but the project in Hartford Super Pedestrian has been one of their top markets. I think there have been over 310,000 rides since they opened, which is the equivalent of going around the world about three times. I would also echo the comment about safety. I don't know that we've had more accidents in the last 2 years than we had previously. And then I'll just make one more comment about scooters themselves, because as most people probably know, the bike program that we had previously, although highly used, it ultimately did not work out. The scooters are much, in particular, much more durable, and as a result have been much more successful in the city in terms of theft and all of that, because they're basically unusable. So people don't do that. They use them for what they were meant for. And then I'll make one last comment. In the city of Hartford, we have the Uplink program for our communities that are lower income. And that is, we've had great uptake from all people across the spectrum using the service. I just want to throw that out there as the body is contemplating this as a regional idea.
Thanks. John, I see your hand up.
Thank you. I just need to be educated, especially as they move to battery bikes and so forth. How are they recharged so that they're usable for the next user?
Good question. Depends on the specific model. So some equipment has swappable batteries. So all of these are remotely monitored. So the operator sees that a certain battery is running low. They can go and swap the battery out with a fresh one and leave the vehicle on the street. I believe Super Pedestrian physically removes the scooter off of the street and charges it in their own facility. So that's another model. The batteries have improved in capacity in that they're not having to charge these that often. So when we talked with Super Pedestrian as part of this study, I think they said something like once a week is common per vehicle. So
I think that average battery 5 hours of operating time.
Yeah. Okay,
thank you.
Any other questions? To kind of go back to what Bob was talking about, I just wanted to say when we first started putting in all these bike lanes, we did have this pretty neat educational pamphlet that we actually included in with our tax bills 1 year that talks to the person who's driving their car and not used to what the hell they're looking at on the road. I'm trying to track that down, but if I could find it, I'll send it out to everybody. It was pretty neat in terms of educational components for people who are driving, not the people that are using the bikes. Because I think that was something that was really confusing for a lot of my residents.
Yeah, that'd be very, very helpful. Yes.
I'll try to find that and get that over
Thank
to
you. Great.
I got to dig back. I've been doing this stuff for, it's like, I'm going back in like 2015 in my files here. I'll find it. Oh. It's good. I promise.
Okay, great.
Any other questions? Oh, Mr. Hart.
Thank you, Mayor. Just wanted to add a few points here. So thank you very much, Andy, Caitlin, and Mike, and the other members of the team. And I wanted to let the board know we're going to continue to work on this at a CROG staff level. And we're organizing a meeting of those towns that we think have a level of density to support a program. You know, we've already sent an invite out to all of you. We'll resend that, and we'll keep the rest of the board informed as we look to grow the program.
Sounds good. All right. With that being said, we will move right along. Andy, thanks again for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
On to our monthly reports. Mr. Hart, turn it over to you.
Thanks, Mayor. So I'm going to move through the various departments and committee reports. I'm not going to touch on each and every one of them. You can find the complete report online. And at the end, I'll turn to John Coleman and see if John wants to add anything from the Transportation Committee. Before I get started, I wanted to introduce Mike Paulus. Mike attended our meeting last month. Mike is the new town manager in Plainville, very experienced. He's coming to us from the town of North Branford, where he worked for many years. So very experienced town manager, and very happy to have him here in our region. Welcome, Mike.
Thanks, Matt.
So moving on to my report, the mayor started off today with a moment of silence in honor of the memory of Sergeant Hamsey and Lieutenant DeMonte and the rest of the law enforcement community and others that have been so dramatically impacted by this. And I wanted to take an opportunity to thank our Capital Region Emergency Planning Council, SEREPSI, ably staffed by Cheryl Assis. For their work, they activated our regional incident communications team, the ICOM team, and provided great coverage to Bristol's dispatch in the days following the shooting, as well as during the wakes and the funeral. And that team was able to fill over 80 shifts with dedicated dispatchers. So that's really, I think, a testament to the strength of our system here. And you know, my thanks to the ICOM team, SEREPSI, Cheryl, and others for coordinating that effort. Moving on to the next item. Later on today at 2 o'clock, our Waste Management and Diversion Steering Committee, comprised of many of you, will meet to talk about a draft report that our consultants are going to present. This is a facility inventory and system assessment. And so we're going to review this with the committee, get their input, get their feedback. And then based on how that goes, we're going to proceed with phase two of the project, which, as you may recall, will involve preparing some short-term disposal options for our region. I think we're all aware of the fact that MIRA has closed its Hartford facility, and we might have an opportunity here to expand the role of our Central Connecticut Solid Waste Authority, CSWA, that's presently staffed by CROG. So the committee and I will keep the rest of the policy board informed as we move forward. Tomorrow, our ad hoc legislative committee chaired by Jason Bauza from East Windsor, we're gonna meet online at 11 o'clock. And we're gonna start our work on a proposed legislative agenda for your consideration. Our goal will be to present it to the full board in January. And you can find all the materials on our website if you're interested. Moving on, I wanted to thank all of you who were able to attend our recent tour of Riverfront Recapture's Plan Park on the Hartford and Windsor line. I want to thank Mike Zaleski and the other folks from Riverfront Recapture from a very informative tour. And we're going to look to do more of that across the region. We'll invite policy board members to come out and see a project in the works. You know, we think it'll be very informative for us all. The Municipal Services Committee met last week on October 18th. There were two items I wanted to note coming out of that meeting. We're going to be holding a separate session for those towns that are interested in exploring regional options for stormwater management. Stormwater management's a big issue for most of us, if not all of us, and we really want to dig into that topic. And we're going to invite some state and other experts as we work through that. And then secondly, we're also going to hold a separate meeting to talk about regional options to resource fair rent commissions. You know, fair rent commissions, it can be challenging to find qualified members. It's somewhat sophisticated to staff, or can be. So we're going to talk about that in more detail too. Moving on, our Personnel and Finance Committee is going to meet at 9:30 a.m. on November 3rd to talk about a proposed performance review process for me, as well as other good topics. We'll keep you informed. Hopefully you have all received an invitation to this event. The National Academy of Public Administration, or NAPA, is going to host its fall meeting next week, November 4th at the Hartford Public Library. And this event is going to focus on the topic of public sector workforce development. And we're going to have two panels with a variety of speakers. I'm moderating one of the panels. Professor Alcadre is moderating the other. We're going to have a keynote address as well. The event's going to run from 8:30 a.m. through 1:30. It does include a luncheon, and hopefully many of you will be able to attend. And we're going to host this. It's going to be held at the Hartford Public Library. So our thanks to them for hosting it as well. Moving on to bipartisan infrastructure law, our staff, Elizabeth, Kyle, and others are continuing to update our website and keep you all informed regarding notices of funding opportunity. Some of the things we're focused on in particular right now is that culvert program, which is it's only for those water bodies that host certain types of migratory fish. But we're doing a mapping exercise and more information to follow regarding those towns that would be eligible for funding under that program. And then I've been saying this a lot, you've probably heard me say it already, really want to encourage you all as you go into your capital planning processes this fall and winter to keep the bipartisan infrastructure law opportunities in mind. And to the extent to which you can, I know it's a challenge, look to budget that local match in your CIP. And we're doing work on a statewide level to see if there are other options to cover that local 20% match, because we know it's a challenge for many, many of our towns. So we are actively working on that too, and we'll keep you posted. Moving on to municipal services, our regional purchasing coalition held its annual meeting on October 18th. It was a very good meeting, as I understand. I want to thank Kim Bona and everyone else involved. I know that's a pretty significant lift. We're doing some good work in the Brownfields area. There's a project in East Hartford we're working on. Also looking at a project from the city of Norwich. So this isn't just for the CROG region. This program is also available to other municipalities across our state. Moving on to community development, our planning team has been conducting outreach visits to our member towns. They've already visited several of you, and we really appreciate the fact that you host those meetings. It's a great opportunity for our team to meet your team in person, develop relationships, and then hear about how we can better serve you. Our community development staff has also created an inventory of affordable housing plans. So if you're a community, if you're still working on your affordable housing plan, you're looking for a good template, a good resource, please check out our website or reach out to one of us and we'll direct you there. And we wanna do more of that work, have these model plans available to you. And then moving on to transportation, a couple things I wanted to note related to the LOTSIP program. The Transportation Committee met earlier this week, approved a selection policy for the upcoming project solicitation. And we also spent some time talking about how the cost and inflation have impacted the program as well, and proposed some funding adjustments there too, which the committee did endorse, and you'll see later on the agenda today. And then lastly, under the area of public safety, Mayor, Cheryl and other members of the team are continuing to do very good work with respect to preparing and submitting the various grant applications. We did host our first regional CERT basic training class. That's a really neat program that that we're able to provide. The class started on September 15th, and we'll graduate on November 3rd. So that completes everything I wanted to touch on, Mayor. I know that was a lot, but I would ask John Coleman if there was anything he wanted to add, and then we can take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. I don't think so. I think the central thing we did is make the adjustment to the LOTSIP program to reflect the cost increases that everyone is facing. And we also approved some cost increases for, I think, three projects to reflect those adjustments. And I think your staffs who participated are fully informed with the new cost limitations. They're in place for 18 months, and we will hopefully be able to reflect adjustments in different direction 18 months from now. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, Howard. Any other questions? John.
Just a thanks to all the staff on the LHTSA program. We're finishing up two. We finished up kind of one last week, and we're finishing up one over the next couple weeks. What an impact on our community for road safety. And I just want to say thanks. Our residents are appreciating safe intersections and safe walkways. Thank you.
Thanks. All right, is Kathy on here for a legislative update? Oh, sorry, we've got our financial piece first.
Sorry, thank you. Just very quickly, this is a financial, we'll be giving you a quarterly financial report. This is very high level by the department level. For this quarter, last quarter, I would just say that we're on track as expected with regards to our finances for this year.
Thanks, Pauline. Any questions? Okay. Now, Kathy.
Actually, there is little to nothing to report. Not quite 2 weeks left to election. And so even the meetings happening are necessary meetings, you know, time sensitive meetings that are being scheduled. So there really is nothing, obviously, no decisions made yet on committee makeup or leadership makeup or chairs or anything. So by the next time we meet, there'll be a lot. Because immediately after Election Day, leadership will start putting all their pieces together. Until then, we're just waiting.
And we all can't wait for it to be over.
Oh, I agree.
Right? Thanks so much, Kathy. Appreciate it.
No problem.
Pauline, for the ethics policy and conflict of interest update.
Our auditor recommended that our board members and committee members sign off on a policy, ethics policy and conflict of interest statement. We're probably going to do this every 2 years after the municipal election once we have new board members. And so the attachment in the agenda had the updated policy and conflict of interest statement that's for members and committee members, and asking for the approval and adoption of those.
All right, state your name first, make a motion, someone.
John Coleman, move.
Thank you, John. Second?
Second, Lori Spielman.
Thanks, Lori. Any questions or comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Motion carries. Thank you. MPO items are TIP amendments, John.
There are four TIP amendments. They're all very straightforward. They don't use any of our money, which is the best thing. And they were all unanimously approved by the Transportation Committee at its most recent meeting, and they recommended the same to the Policy Board, and I would so move.
Thank you, John. Do I have a second?
Bob Bessel, I will second.
Bob, thank you. Any questions or comments? All those in favor, say aye.
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 Any opposed? Thank you all. Motion carries. Item number 9, we've got some correspondence and handouts, so I'll turn it over to Matt.
Hey, Mayor. Yes, we have three items here. First is a support letter that we prepared in support of the DOT's application seeking funding under the Reconnecting Communities Program under the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law. And this would be a project related to the Greater Hartford Mobility Study. We've had some presentations on that in the past. And actually, we've talked about bringing the DOT and the consulting team back for that purpose to provide the Policy Board with an update. But this would allow them to proceed seeking funding for some design and permitting work. Certainly not the project in its entirety, but excited with the fact that the DOT has submitted the application. And then the next two items are our comments regarding the state's rail plan, both passenger rail and then freight rail. I want to thank Kara and other members of our team, Chris and others, for preparing the draft for our review. And on passenger rail, I did want to highlight the fact that we are encouraging the DOT to make sure that all of these stations along the line are placed into the funded category under the state CIP. As you may know, at least a Flatbush station is currently in the overprogrammed category or unfunded category. So we're advocating for that change along with a couple of other things. And happy to take any questions anybody might have regarding these, Mayor.
All right. Are there any questions? Pete?
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to comment on the state rail plan. The town of the rail station in Windsor Center has long been part of the state rail plan. Unfortunately, in this draft plan, it is no longer included. And so I just became aware of this in my review in the last few days. So I've not had a chance to speak with CROG staff on that. So I will try to reach out to Matt at the end of this meeting so that those comments potentially could be included in the letter to the state. This is a pretty big deviation from their long range plan. And so the town of Windsor will be commenting to include funding for the town center station here in Windsor. So just wanted to make folks aware of that change in the draft plan.
Thanks, Pete. Matt.
Thank you, Mayor. Thank you. Thank you, Peter. We do have, you know, some language that references your station in the letter here, but you know, I'll see if there's a way to strengthen and amplify that based on the change you noted.
John? Oh, John, you're muted.
Maybe not for this version of the rail plan, but I've been reading a lot of success stories of not rails to trail, trails next to operating rails that you can have bike paths next to live rail trail, live rail line. And it's not something that I think we've looked at, but especially in Eastern Connecticut, where we have very slow freight rails, have a nice corridor that could be an incredible bike path that could connect through to the East Coast Greenway. So just food for thought for the future, but I'm finding that it has worked successfully. The railroads hate it, but usually their corridor is very wide and you only have issues maybe along bridge areas. But again, Eastern Connecticut, we have 2 to 4 trains a day going up a major corridor, and it'd be a great bike next to it.
Thanks, John. Any other questions or comments on any of the correspondence? Okay, Matt, any other comments before we wrap this up?
And nothing under other business either, Mayor.
All righty, I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
John Coleman, move we adjourn.
Seconded by everybody, but
Lori Spielman
specifically.
Lori Spielman, second.
We are adjourned, everybody. The time is 12:49 p.m. Thank you all very much. We'll see you again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor.
Bye.